into the Foreign Service. How did you happen to, I guess you joined the Army?
Yes. I joined the Army to escape Arkansas. I grew up in Arkansas, and I wanted to go see the world. And at the time, you know, back in the 60s, women generally were in school teaching professions and nursing professions, and I didn't want to do either one of them. But I didn't. The one thing I wanted to do was get out and see the world. And, of course, the old Army recruiter came roaring through town and joined the Army, see the world, and the great recruiting information they have about nothing about war, but, of course, everything about where you can go and the good education. Just the same techniques that they're using in today's attempt to recruit the youth of America into the military. And here, well, 40 years ago, it was to go straight on to Vietnam, and here it is 40 years later, straight on to great ticket, straight into Baghdad.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. The pressure tactics are a little different in detail, but basically, yeah, they're working the same way they did then. Now, you went into the Women's Army Corps, is
yes.
that right? Now, this is back in those days, the Army was segregated, men and women. It was not integrated the way it is nowadays. Could you tell us a little bit about where you went as a member of the Army?
My first assignment was right in the heart of anti-war activities in America, to San Francisco. So that was really interesting, being a little second lieutenant in the Army, right there in San Francisco, where you had Haight-Ashbury, where lots of soldiers, military folks, were going AWOL. They weren't about to go to Vietnam, and so they drifted into the Haight-Ashbury scene, and then there were, you know, just tens of thousands of anti-war protesters that at least once a month they were having some grand parade and march, you know, march from the bay to the sea. So here I was, you know, from Arkansas, brand new in the Army, and looking at all of this stuff that was going on. I mean, and certainly I knew when I was in college in Arkansas, there was a great split in what America should be doing and in the interpretation of what America was doing. And I, at the time, fell for the government line on this. And I would say, oh, yes, we've got to protect the people of South Vietnam from the guys in the North. And so I joined the Army thinking that was the right thing to do, and then became disenchanted, like lots and lots of other people, on the techniques that the United States were using and the bombings. I mean, the numbers of people we killed in order to save, the illegal and the lies that illegal operations and lies that were told to the American public about what our military was being ordered to do and did. So I, over time, became very disenchanted with the Vietnam War.
So your own personal opinion started to shift
yes.
a little bit. Of course,
yep.
you were still in the Army and still doing. Women in those days, what kind of work did you do while you were?
Mostly it was administrative stuff.
So it would be paperwork.
Paperwork, some communications, being company commanders of other women's Army Corps units, like WAC detachments or WAC companies. It wasn't until in the late 70s, really, that the role and the opportunities for women in the military really expanded a lot, so that you could go into other career fields like military police, military intelligence, that women could start flying helicopters and fly fixed-winged aircraft, that for the Navy they could become captains of ships. In the early days when I was in, it was very limited what you could do. And then with a lot of rabble-rousing, quite honestly, from women in the military who were saying, you can't deny us the opportunities that, you know, good education, good opportunities that had great relevance on the outside, that if once you got out of the military, you could get some good jobs using those skills you'd been trained. But women were kind of reconciled in or put into the low-paying jobs.
Yeah. So there was a not-so-glassy ceiling back
yeah.
in those days.
So we had some good battles within the military on the expansion of the role of women in the military. And nowadays, women are allowed to go into virtually everything in the Army except still the combat arms of infantry and artillery, types of artillery, and then tanks, armor. But and in the Air Force and the Navy, the women have been pretty well given the opportunities in all areas. Marine Corps is still kind of a holdout. They don't have women in a lot of the career fields there. The greatest leader in all of these military units for the utilization and opportunities for women is the Coast Guard. If I had to do over again, I'd join the Coast Guard because they've got good missions and great training and have always pretty well been the leaders in allowing women to be what you can be.
And also have tended not to get sent off to hot battle fronts to worry, where you have to worry about your life ending suddenly.
Yeah. Well, although, quite honestly, the Coast Guard has been involved in the Gulf area. They are patrolling the Gulf. The Coast Guard is all over the place, and very short staff now that they've got such incredible security responsibilities on the borders of the United States now.
Yeah, I noticed also that you were in the you went to the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. How did you go to a naval institution while you were in the Army?
Well, I was selected for that as when I was in the reserve component for the Army Reserves. There are like 12 or 13, 14 lieutenant colonels or colonels that are selected each year to go to what they call a senior service college. It's kind of the top rung of your military education. And for the Army, they get like 7 slots to the Army War College. And those slots go to the guys who are in the combat arms, the spearhead of the military. So I, as a woman, from the reserve component, I wasn't selected to go to the Army War College. Pardon me. And then looking at the other colleges that I was eligible for, might as well go to one that's in a beautiful little town right on the ocean where you can do some sailing and all. And it was the top academic of the war colleges. There's the National War College in Washington, the Army one in Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania. The Naval War College was offering a master's, or was able to give a master's degree for the year that you spent there, because its academic work was quite rigorous.
So for 1 year's work, you would get a master's degree. Well, that sounds like a good deal and everything. So then how did you end up being in the Foreign Service?
Well, it was because of the poor utilization of women in the military, actually. I had been in the military. I'd gone back and forth in and out of the military for a while, and at one stage I stayed in for about 6 years and had risen to the rank of lieutenant colonel, and I wanted to go into the defense attaché program. These are the men and women now who serve in U.S. embassies and are the liaisons with military forces in those countries. And actually, some of them are intelligence people that are doing intelligence work there. Well, I had been in Central America down in Panama at the U.S. Southern Command back in the middle 80s. I mean, these are controversial times where the U.S. was supporting the Contras, although I didn't have anything to do with that. It's mostly a CIA operation, not a U.S. military operation. But I'd been doing a lot of work, civic action, humanitarian assistance in Panama and Honduras. And in Honduras, what we were doing was the military was actually paying off the Honduran government for allowing the CIA and the Contras to use Honduran territory to mount operations into Nicaragua. Well, the payoff was that we, the U.S. military, were building things for Honduras. We built schools. We built medical clinics. We built roads in places where the Hondurans would never build them, but they thought, well, if the U.S. military is we can arm twist them, we'll give them some challenges like they've never seen, which they did. Well, anyway, I'd been doing all this work, and for whatever reason, I decided I wanted to become a defense attaché, so I put in my application for it, and the Army came back and said, you can't be in the defense attaché program. And I said, well, why not? Well, you're a woman. I said, well, why does that make any difference? Well, you won't relate well to those macho guys of Central and South America. And I said, well, look, I've been doing this for 3 years. I'm doing fine. And even the four-star general in charge of this, the Southern Command, sent him a cable to Washington saying, she's been doing all this stuff. I mean, she'll do fine in the Defense Attaché program, and I can't believe we don't have women in that program anyway. I mean, what's going on? Well, anyway, the Army got obstinate, and I got obstinate, and at that point, I had taken the Foreign Service exam and passed it, and here was an option, and I thought, well, even though I was pretty senior in the military, you know, sometimes in your life, you just need to make some changes, and so I moved on over to the diplomatic side of things.
And you served in a number of different places, and some of them rather adventurous. I guess we will probably talk about that in the next few minutes. Ann Wright, the diplomat who resigned over the start of the Iraq War and several other related issues. And we were talking about how she got into the diplomatic corps and various places that she's worked. Now, you ended up working in Afghanistan. And
indeed.
That was one of your last posts.
Yes. Well, if I can go back a little earlier, though,
okay,
very first post in the Foreign Service ended up being back in Central America. And in fact, it was kind of on the other side of the border of what I'd been working with on civic action projects in Honduras to kind of pay off the Honduran government for this movement of Contras and CIA into Nicaragua fighting the Sandinistas. And lo and behold, what was my first assignment in the Foreign Service? Going to Nicaragua. So very quickly I was on the other side looking at what seeing firsthand what the Sandinistas, what types of programs they had and all. And it was a very difficult and challenging first assignment in which half of the U.S. embassy was kicked out by the Sandinistas. Deal cut with the U.S. government. If the U.S. would stop supporting the Contras, the Sandinistas then said they would let free and fair elections, or they'd let elections happen. And as it turned out, the United States government sponsored 22 opposition parties that ultimately came together as a coalition and defeated the Sandinistas.
Well, as I understand it, that election was actually scheduled in advance, and it was not a question of their guaranteeing an election. From the U.S. point of view, they were guaranteeing a free and fair election as opposed to a non-free and non-fair one. But they probably intended that in the first place. It's just
yes.
who had money to run against the Sandinistas, who had the will to run against them.
Yeah,
they were a very popular government doing a lot of things for the people, as
mm-hmm.
I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see firsthand, what did you see firsthand in Nicaragua while you were there?
Well, I would say that by the time I got there, which was the last 2 years of it, there had been such extraordinary pressures put on the revolution, on the Sandinista revolution, that the original very good aims, I think, of the Sandinistas in terms of trying to do things for the people of Nicaragua that the dictator Somoza had steadfastly refused to do. The Sandinistas certainly had education, medical, social services that the dictator wasn't about to waste his money on. And when the Sandinistas reached out to the international community for help after they had kicked Somoza out, they reached out to the United States, and the United States said, no, Somoza was our guy. I think the term was, he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. And representing many of the corporate interests of the United States, of fruit
United
companies.
Fruit,
and, yeah. And so the Sandinistas didn't get a warm reception when they went to Washington. So they needed to have help for their revolution someplace. And at the time, other countries in the region that had undergone a revolution and who had help available, Fidel Castro in Cuba came to the rescue really fast. And the Soviet Union was supporting. Well, when those two things happen, then Katie barred the door. Washington's going to get its back up really bad. And the economic pressures that they put on the Sandinistas, the military pressures through the Contras, you can argue it on both ways. What came first? Was it the pressures, or was it the pressures from the U.S. that led to a curtailment, really, of the types of services that the Sandinistas were able to give to their people, and then the type of security apparatus that they felt was necessary in order to protect the revolution and protect people in it from these inroads from the Contras. When I got there, there had been a dissolution in, I think the it was no longer the heyday of the revolution, and indeed the society, from the perspective, of course, of the U.S. Embassy and us as U.S. government employees that were, you know, the enemy in that country, and of course our lives were constrained quite a bit. The Sandinistas had tails on us. I mean, we were followed where we went. Our telephones were tapped. Many of the people of the opposition to the Sandinistas said that, yes, they were being followed. Their telephones were tapped. And in that way, the revolution, I think, lost its kind of moral high ground when they did the things that they were so against that the dictator had done to them.
Yeah, it's one of these very sad stories. I guess one of my cousins is married to one of the Sandinista officials.
Oh.
And so I've seen this extensively from the Sandinistas' point of view.
Yes.
And I understand that the Sandinistas ended up becoming a sort of a rigid, security-oriented party, and they had to fight a war, hot war.
That's right.
And so that changed everybody's point of view.
Mm-hmm. If there had not been a war, arguably it could have been a revolution that really would have extensively helped the people of Nicaragua, just as in Cuba. I mean, without the military pressure that the United States was putting on the Cuban Revolution, it could have taken a very different turn. But the pressures that the corporate and commercial interests of the United States that had been affected when dictators were overthrown, Batista in Cuba and then Somoza in Nicaragua, pushed the United States government, or maybe pushed, or they went together in a way that never allowed either one of those revolutions to do what I think they originally felt they needed to do.
Yes.
And you were speaking about Sandinista officials. Well, there's a very interesting thing going on right now with one of the former, still a Sandinista, but one of the former gung-ho Sandinistas, a woman by the name of Dora Maria Telles, who now is a well-accomplished, well-respected historian of Central America. And she was to be coming up here to the Massachusetts, to Harvard, and a six-month fellowship at the Harvard Divinity School, you know, to teach for 6 months. And the Bush administration has now classified her as a terrorist based on the fact that she, back in the late 70s, was a part of the groups that were going against Somoza, and they are now classifying her as a terrorist, even though for the last 30 years she's had visas and has come to the United States and taught in the United States several times. Mm-hmm. But now they're refusing to let her come to the United States to teach.
Yeah, so this is another case where this security-oriented change in U.S. Way of operating is affecting people who really peripheral to it.
Oh, absolutely, and it's where political retaliation is taking place, because you have in this Bush administration, you've got the same guys that were a part of the Reagan Contra operation. You've got Otto Reich, you've got Elliot Abrams, you've got all of those guys that were a part of the United States' decision to use military force in Nicaragua, and they're the same guys that are in power now, and they're the ones that are taking this opportunity, their time and power, to get back at anybody that dared stick a finger in their eye.
And there have been memos that leaked about using the, quote, Salvador option, unquote, in various countries, including Iran,
mm-hmm.
that remind one of the, you know, what these same people did in the more distant past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and right now there's a situation going on that we should watch very carefully, where there's a fellow who has done has murdered and all down in Panama and I believe in Cuba, and he has been allowed to come into the United States, and he's requesting asylum. And I mean, the types of stuff that he's done in these other countries certainly rise to the level that at least they're calling him a terrorist. And if we're giving asylum to that type of person,
if he's not a terrorist, he's probably a certifiable war criminal, you know, mm-hmm. one way or another.
Yeah.
I need to remind people you're listening to Thinking Out Loud on WUML Lowell, and we're talking with Anne Wright, the diplomat who resigned over the start of the Iraq War. Right now we're talking about her work in the Foreign Service. She served in Nicaragua for a while, and then where else did you serve?
Well, from Nicaragua, I went back to Grenada. I'd been in Grenada in the early 80s with the military as a part of the, well, depending on the way you look at it, the intervention force, the rescue force, the invasion force. I'd been there as part of the international law team and the International Claims Commission, and then with the Civic Action and Humanitarian Assistance Group. So I was helping first make sure that the U.S. forces were living up to their responsibilities of the law of land warfare. Indeed, they weren't. There was looting. There was thievery by U.S. soldiers that ultimately we prosecuted. We had a prisoner of war camp for the 1,000 Cubans that were building a runway and having to supervise that in terms
basically
of...
Basically, they were construction workers mm-hmm. who were caught up in this.
Yeah. That's right. And for the, about 7 days that we held them until an international agreement accord was reached through the Mexican government, they were the ones that were talking for the Cubans about how to repatriate these folks. We kept them in a concertina wire camp. But it was really interesting because we, you know, considering right now we've got prisoners in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and we had Cuban prisoners for a short time in Grenada. And even in that short time, things were going wrong in the camp, that people had to really watch what junior enlisted military police and infantry people were doing to people that they considered their, you know, the opponents, the enemies. And we had to step in several times in that short period of time. So for the U.S. military not to have had properly trained and supervised people in all of these prisons so that abuses like went on in Abu Ghraib, it's unconscionable what happened. The lack of senior leadership in making sure that those prisons were adequately monitored for what tragically seems to be a concept of a lot of people that are the guards of people that are the prisoners, whether it's in civilian life or in military. There are excuses that are excesses that take place.
Standard operating procedures in some prisons in the United States are similar enough to the ones we saw at Abu Ghraib.
So I as a you know, longtime military person now, 29 years, and I'm horrified at what I see that's been allowed to go on in Iraq. A lot of it is because of very bad operation plans to start with, where you never had enough troops to go into that place. First, I say we shouldn't have gone, but if you were going to go, you got to do it right. And the Bush administration, particularly Donald Rumsfeld, undercut the ability of the military to actually do its job and do it professionally, because it reduced the number of people that were a part of that operation plan by at least one-third, if not more. And you have the Chief of Staff of the Army, General Shinseki, who was warning from well before, a year before the operation took place, that it could not work. You could not invade and occupy a country as large as Iraq with as few people as Donald Rumsfeld said, that's what we're going to do because we're doing it lean and mean. It's a new concept. We're changing the way the Army operates. Well, you can see what Rumsfeld's theory has done. It's not good for the military, and it's certainly not good for the United States.
Yeah, it certainly isn't. From the experience in Grenada, you feel like you did see a prison camp that worked as it was supposed to, as under the proper supervision.
That's right, with supervision all the time.
It can be done.
It can be done, yeah. But it's labor intensive. And we still don't have enough troops to be controlling and properly supervising the huge numbers of Iraqis that, for whatever reason, have been thrown into these jails. Now, whether it's a lot of Iraqis that were prisoners under Saddam Hussein, I mean, common criminals, not political prisoners, that were turned out on the streets and then have to be brought back into that system. But then the huge numbers of people that are just picked up because they're in the wrong house at the wrong time. And rather than having enough people that you can quickly, you know, quickly, but still doing your job to make sure that you're getting the information that you need to determine whether or not these people have anything to do with activities against the U.S. forces. But they're keeping lots of people in jail for extended periods of time in Iraq. And then not to say what's going on in Guantanamo, where you have years that have gone by with people that are languishing in that place.
Yeah, it's an outrageous situation. But I guess in what was your next posting?
Sorry, I keep
might as well just keep moving forward.
We'll keep moving in little.
The hour will eventually be over.
Well, from Grenada, then it was Somalia was the next big place that I went. I eventually was seconded to the United Nations operation there, and was the head of the Justice Division for the United Nations, trying to reconstruct or reform the Somali police, the judicial system, and the prison system, doing those types of things that we're doing also in Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, I've had lots of experience in all this stuff, and the experience in Somalia should teach us a lesson that indeed you need to go in with if you don't have the agreement with all sides. And indeed, in the warlords of Somalia, when the U.S.
came, you aren't going to do peacekeeping if you don't have some agreement with the other Balda sides.
That's right. The warlords agreed initially when there were 30,000 U.S. military that came into that country, but as soon as the 30,000 overwhelming force left, and it was a very small U.N. force initially of less than 5,000 really, the warlords started reasserting their authority and. The reaction to any attempt at the international community to assist in getting some sort of a organized government back in order. I mean, we know the history of it. It didn't work. No. From there, I went to, Uzbekistan in Central Asia to help reopen open for the first time an embassy in one of the 15 former Soviet republics, was there for a couple of months, and then my next long assignment was in Kyrgyzstan, also in Central Asia.
Kyrgyzstan is an interesting place, I understand.
Indeed, it's a marvelous, beautiful place, and now has quite a fascinating political history, where the first person to be elected as president of Kyrgyzstan after it became an independent country, a scientist by the name of Oskar Akayev, who originally was quite a moderate and good leader, but unfortunately over time started developing the tendencies of the other dictators in the area, of Karimov in Uzbekistan next door and Nazarbayev in Kazakhstan on the other side. And then he has been overthrown in a coup just last month, where the people of Kyrgyzstan said, enough of the excesses that you have, where you've put down the political opposition, where your family has suddenly become very rich from your tenure as president of this country, and Akayev was thrown out of the country. So, and now the U.S. has a military base there, and the Russians said, well, if the U.S. is having a base there, we want a base there. So the Kyrgyz went from having no military other than their very small own national military to having U.S.
Some of the biggest militaries in the world.
Yeah, I'm sure they're just kind of shaking their heads going like, what in the world happened with this?
What was I thinking?
Uh-huh.
So that was an interesting place. You weren't there, you were there during a time of relative stability?
That's right. There was a lot of movement in the political scene political parties were forming, grassroots organizing was taking place in a reasonably peaceful environment. Although
healthy democratic tendencies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That was before Akayev started playing hardball with the opposition. There was the beginning part of what was the Islamic Unity Movement, and elements of groups out of particularly Uzbekistan that were saying that this brutal dictator that they have in Uzbekistan needs to go. And indeed, on the Islamic side, the Islamic religion, the Muslim religion, needed to gain more prominence. And Nazarbayev was, or Karimov, pardon me, was clamping down hard on them. And as he clamped down hard in Uzbekistan, they kind of squirted out the other side over into Kyrgyzstan and were up in the mountains there. So it was interesting on one security level, but on the local political level, things were reasonably stable then.
Yeah. So what was your next stop?
And then the next stop, Africa, back to Africa, this time West Africa in Sierra Leone. And I was there as the... Just as a peace was kind of brokered with a military group that had taken over the country, then a civil war erupted again while I was there, to the extent that the capital city of Freetown was taken over by the Revolutionary United Front, a group of people whose signature techniques of people control was tragically chopping off people's arms and legs and noses and ears and really a very brutal reign of terror out in the countryside, which then came to the cities when a formal alliance with elements of the Sierra Leonean military was effected. It was such a dangerous and chaotic condition in the capital city that a decision was made that we needed to evacuate our embassy and close it down. And indeed, that triggered an evacuation of 2,500 people over a period of 3 days, which was the largest evacuation that the United States had done since Vietnam. We were out of Sierra Leone for over a year until regional military forces headed by the Nigerians came back in and actually pushed out the RUF and the now what was called the Armed Forces Revolutionary Council, the AFRC, and pushed them out of Freetown. Then we were able to go back in, reopen our embassy only for a small period of time, for about 5 months, until there was more trouble. The RUF came back in. The RUF was, of course, going after the one great natural resource of Sierra Leone, which was diamonds. And indeed, this whole term called conflict diamonds really came out of Sierra Leone, where there were forces from Liberia, groups of people that were being trained by Muammar Gaddafi and then Charles Taylor were coming in and trying to gain control over those diamond fields.
And selling the diamonds on the international market to raise money for military operations and
That's
things,
right.
too.
Yeah, that's right. And one thing we can say for the United States that indeed our Congress and certain congressmen and women have been leading international movement to better control diamonds and to force diamond companies like De Beers to acknowledge where diamonds are coming from and not to buy diamonds on the illegal market. I mean, to the extent that you think De Beers is willing to cut their corporate profit by humanitarian look at where diamonds come from.
Well, actually, as I understand it, the diamond market is not very straightforward market, and De Beers controls the price of diamonds by controlling the amount that get released, and that they're not a very valuable commodity if they were all released at once. So conflict diamonds were reducing De Beers' profits because they were being sold in unofficial markets, and they were very interested in stopping this trade. And, I guess they're using any method they can reach to do that.
Well, to the extent that if no one would buy those conflict diamonds, that would be the best. Then maybe people wouldn't fight over them. Tragically, I think for Sierra Leone, it still got more instability in its future, even though after the second time of an evacuation of the capital and then finally coming back in, then the British kind of led a movement to get an international peacekeeping force in there. And for about 5 years, there have been up to 18,000 UN peacekeepers in that country, which have in one way, kind of calm some of the problems.
These are from African countries mostly, is that right?
I believe most of them are, although the Brits and there were some European countries. The United States did not contribute any into that. In fact, after the challenges of Somalia, the probability, I think, of the United States ever putting anybody in Africa is very low. It's a place I think our U.S. military is afraid of. Our politicians are afraid of it. And Africa, and I think it's a racist look.
A racist look, maybe, mm-hmm. but it's also the fruits of colonialism that were mm-hmm. never corrected and could have been corrected over the years. You end up with very, very poor people, desperate for anything they can get, and very strong men.